You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory. This is UBC Happy Hour, a show that is all about what's happening on UBC's campus, produced by the UBC Affairs Collective. If you like what you hear and you want to help, send us an email to ubcaffairs@citr.ca. I'm Lilane.
And I'm Alex Lenz. And welcome to the show, everyone. It's just Lilane and I in studio now, but it won't be just us two for long because we have a packed show today. And later on in the show, we're going to be joined by the Speed Cubing Club at UBC, which I'm really excited about. They solve like Rubik's Cubes and other types of speed cubes that Lilane and I have no clue about, but we're going to learn. And hopefully we'll be able to solve one. That's going to be later on in the show. So, so today on the show, first up, we're going to hear an interview that I did with Tintin Yang, who is on the student exec here at CITR. And she's also an outreach worker for the Sexual Assault Support Center here at UBC. This month at UBC was Sexual Assault Awareness Month. The whole month of January was dedicated to raising awareness about sexual assault on campus. We're going to hear that interview. And if this is a topic that is triggering for you, the interview is about 15 minutes. So we invite you to tune back in around 5:18, 5:20, around then. So this is the interview. And we'll be back after that. Outreach worker at the Sexual Assault Support Center at UBC, and she's also part of the student exec here at CITR. So hi, Tintin.
Hello.
So what is the Sexual Assault Support Center?
The SASC is an organization committed to the education, support, and empowerment of people of all genders who are survivors or victims of sexualized violence, as well as their friends and family, and we operate from an intersectional and anti-oppressive framework. Yeah.
Cool. And what are some of the services offered at the SASC?
So some of our services include crisis and short-term emotional support and safety planning, legal, medical, and campus-related advocacy, police, court, and hospital accompaniments, including sexual assault service at UBC Urgent Care Center, referrals to on- and off-campus resources. We have a resource area at the SASC office in the Nest. We have a volunteer program for UBC students, and we also have our Healthier Masculinities program, and we have a variety of outreach services, including workshops and other events that we put on. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, there's so much going on at SASC. It's kind of really awesome to see how much, like, interdisciplinary kind of activities are happening. Can you tell us about your role as an outreach worker at SASC?
So as an outreach worker, I am one of the people that kind of facilitate some of the events and workshops that we put on as part of our education aspect of SASC. In the past, I volunteered for the SASC for 2 years, so I started as soon as I came into university, and now I work for the Sexual Assault Support Center. It's been a busy month because of Sam, so that's been on my mind. But it's really great, and I love my job.
That's awesome. So let's talk about Sam. So Sam is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and it's happening for the month of January at UBC. So we're kind of coming into like the closing phases, I guess, of the month. Mm-hmm. So what were some of the events that were offered as part of Sam?
So there were a number of events that were offered. I guess I wasn't part of all of them because Sam is actually, created by UBC, or it's a UBC-affiliated event, whereas the SASC is part of the AMS. So we were only a part of some of the event planning, but we had a good impact in it. Some of the events included Denim Day, which is on January 17th, which is basically a day that in which we advise people to wear denim to show solidarity and support for sexual assault survivors. And we also had a few workshops with the Equity and Inclusion Office for responding to disclosures. And we also had this really exciting workshop that I was fortunate enough to be part of, which was the Sex, Substances, and Consent workshop that we had on the 18th. It was run in part with Vice of UBC, of VAMS. I don't know if you know.
Yeah. I think they're new this year. But maybe if you want to talk more about that, because I think it's... the cross-sectional aspect is really important.
Yeah, totally. It was a really important discussion, I think, to be had, because there's so much, like, it's a really nuanced conversation about, like, what consent looks like in a culture where, you know, drugs and substance use is becoming a little bit more normalized. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes the definition of consent is suggesting that individuals who are able to consent cannot be intoxicated, right? But obviously we're aware that people can have sex and be drunk and also give consent, but what does that look like? That's always a big conversation. Or, like, you know, take drugs, like smoking weed, or like, you know, doing other sorts of, like, party drugs and, like, having sex. Like, how does consent work in those contexts? It was a really interesting and, I think, valuable discussion that was had on the topic. So, yeah.
Yeah. Were there any kind of conclusions that were come to at that discussion? Or, I don't know, maybe conclusions is a very definitive word, but I don't know, maybe like advice for people who, you know, you're at a party and like, how do you give consent? I don't know.
In those circumstances? It's tough because obviously there is no like definitive answer that was reached because it is such a, you know, highly, nuanced, like difficult to really have definitive answers for
kind of
conversation. But I guess like the broad kind of theme that we were all drawing towards was like communication and the varying forms in which that takes, and like, you know, making sure to check in with yourself at all given points during sexual activity. It's one of those things where it's really tough because, again, like, I would never want to be a prescriptivist, because consent and speaking about consent looks different for people depending on, you know, where they're at in their own like understanding of their own sexualities and stuff like that. But yeah, like, again, the broad themes that we drew upon was just like, you know, talking with your partner or partners. It's hard. I can't remember exactly what we said, but, you know.
Yeah, no, it is a very, like, it's, like you said, it's so nuanced, but it's also so relevant because, you know, young people, which is most of what, like, UBC looks like, is young people studying here and living on campus as well. And there's a lot of drinking involved in like that party culture of university. And, you know, it was just, I think 2 weeks ago that, you know, the conviction of there was, you know, a gentleman who was sentenced for rape like at one of the frat houses, and reading the details, like, it was so obvious that alcohol was, you know, really involved in that story. And, you know, the victim like couldn't give any consent because she was drunk. So it's something that I think is so relevant for, I think, especially the university context. Really important discussion to be had. And it's really cool, I think, that AMS Vice was involved in that as well, because I don't think it's like a conversation for to be siloed. It kind of crosses like many boundaries.
Totally, yeah.
Maybe more about Denim Day, because I am curious about that. So maybe just a brief history of Denim Day.
So I'm not an expert on the topic by any means, but I know that it's an event that was kind of in response to a ruling that happened in Italy, I think, in like the 90s, where there was a woman who was she was claiming that someone had sexually assaulted her, but I think one of the judges ruled that, oh, because your jeans were so tight, you must have had to remove them yourself or something like that. Therefore, that it wasn't sexual assault, or like, therefore it was rape or something like that.
Like, where is the logic? That's,
I know,
so ridiculous.
I know. So basically it's kind of like a response to the absurdity of that. But then also, like, you know, what is born out of that is just a day where folks can show their solidarity or support for people who have been sexually assaulted, or just like to kind of contribute a bit more of their input into like the conversation about consent awareness and education.
Yeah, that's awesome. So why is it important to have a month dedicated to talking about sexual assault on campus?
In a campus like context, it's incredibly important because, like, I mean, this isn't just centered to campuses in general, but we live in a rape culture, you know, so it's really important to talk about these issues because they affect people in their daily lives every single day. And it's one of those things that people definitely, you know, are a little bit more shy to talk about or converse about because it's a little bit more of like a, I guess for some reason people think it's a really sensitive, or it is a really sensitive issue, but it's an issue that people don't want to talk about. But yeah, it's just good to kind of remove some of the stigma that's surrounding sexual assault and basically opening up a dialogue regarding the issue kind of promotes practices of, you know, creating cultures of consent and stuff like that. So yeah, that's why I think Sam is important.
Yeah, and I think it's also, I don't know, I guess in my opinion, I think it's cool that Sam, the events were, there were many different types of events, like film screenings, workshops, just having booths out. So it was, I think it was approachable for different people. You know, you might not feel comfortable going to a workshop talking about, I don't know, consent in terms of like drugs and alcohol, but maybe going to like a film screening and having a dialogue about that might be a better model for someone else to discuss sexual assault. So yeah, I think that that was really interesting. And yeah, for our listeners, you might remember that Ryan Patrick Jones, who is a contributor, did a piece on kind of the changing lens of like men contributing to the dialogue of rape culture, and he interviewed the founder of Healthier Masculinities, and it was so interesting, and it seems like such an important topic, and I love that the Sexual Assault Support Center here at UBC has that as kind of a service offered, because I think it's so important to have different angles to approach the dialogue, and it really seems like SASC is doing that.
Yeah, totally. The Healthier Masculinities program is probably one of the most, like, I mean, not to say that everything else isn't important, but, like, it's one of the more, like, nuanced kind of, like, new approaches to, like, consent education or talking about issues that obviously are very pertinent to men, but makes it in a more like approachable way for people to, for men to like kind of get involved with. Because often I find that some of the discourses surrounding like, you know, sexual assault or like feminism, like whatever, it often isn't a very like welcoming environment for men sometimes, because a lot of the time it is like, yes, like women or, you know, trans folks or non-binary folks should take, you know, the front of this conversation because their survivor or like their experiences are so centered in it. But then that also leaves us at like an impasse when like men don't really have a way to understand or like kind of divulge their feelings surrounding it, because yeah, it's too broad of a brush to paint folks or who are, you know, masculine as like everyone who's a man is like terrible and like, you know, totally submits to like rape culture. Like that's not necessarily the case. And we need to open up those channels for men to talk about those issues, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just like conversations that I've had with male friends, it's like, how do you deal with, privilege, and maybe like, maybe you feel a sense of guilt for being a man, and you know, you need somewhere to discuss that. And that's a perfectly, I think, valid like feeling to have. Mm-hmm. And so, and how do you digest those feelings and ultimately, you know, become a better member of society? And that's kind of, I think, what all of this is trying to accomplish, is like a better society for everyone. Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe going back to kind of the idea of the survivor-centered approach. So if someone were to come into SASC, what kind of experience could they expect to kind of have?
Yeah, so I guess because everybody who, you know, is a survivor of sexual assault or is like someone who's supporting someone who's a survivor of sexual assault has a very different experience with that. It is really highly dependent on what the survivor or client wants in the situation, because, you know, as I said, like everyone's experience with sexual assault is different and everyone's response to trauma is different. So as a survivor-centric, you know, intersectional operating facility, I think that we try to not operate in a way that's like prescriptivist, and we don't have like an exact, you know, timeline or schedule.
Like a one size fits all model. Yeah,
exactly. Because people aren't like one size fits all and situations aren't one size fits all. So, yeah, it's very different, but it's of course like operating in a way that centers survivor experiences and, essentially assist them in a way that meets them where they're at. So there's never any pressure to, you know, divulge like your entire experience, you know, in a way that could like totally re-traumatize somebody or like, you know, trigger them in some way. You can come, you know, months after you've been sexually assaulted or anything like that, because, you know, people respond to trauma differently, right? Like, no one wants to talk about it. Maybe, well, not nobody, but some people don't want to talk about it like the day after it happened or anything like that. So I think that there's not that many expectations that are required for people to come in, you know.
Yeah. So if students or I don't know, other members of the UBC community want to access the Sexual Assault Support Center, you know, where is it located? Like, what are the hours?
Yeah, so we're in the AMS Student Nest in room 3127, and our hours are 8 to 10, 7 days a week. So we're pretty accessible, I would hope.
Yeah, awesome. And I understand that the hours have been extended from past years. So, yeah, that's good to hear. And then I guess there's also volunteer opportunities for students at SASC. So if students are interested in volunteering, what kind of things could they get involved with at SASC?
Yeah, so it's a little bit tricky because we only recruit volunteers once a year at the beginning of the school year, just because volunteers do go through a relatively like long and extensive training for this kind of thing, because it is a pretty sensitive topic. So things that you can do if you're a volunteer, so you can be an office volunteer or you can do outreach volunteering. So I did both in my time volunteering at the SASC. So office volunteer is like a bit more like the clerical kind of like behind the scenes stuff. And outreach is just doing like things like tabling, assisting with presentations. So like helping, you know, someone like me do workshops. It's a pretty good experience, I would say.
Yeah, that's so awesome. So thank you for joining us. And is there anything coming up next week that kind of, I guess, January's almost over, which I'm so stunned by. Is there anything happening next week, kind of like a wrap-up for SAM or anything like that?
Yeah, so one event that I'm aware of that someone on SASC will be for the panel is the Sex in All Languages Dialogue. So basically that's a conversation, I believe, about sex and consent in different cultures, so cross-cultural kind of perspective on it.
Wow. Cool.
And it's taking place on the 30th. I think it's in one of the residences, actually, at UBC, like Vanier, I think. It's in one of their, like,
Common rooms.
Okay. Like that. Yeah, I think it's that. It says that it's at 5 p.m. 5 p.m. on the 30th.
Cool. That sounds so interesting and so relevant to the UBC community that's so multicultural. Really cool events, and thank you so much for joining us, and we love the work that SASC is doing, so yeah, keep up the great job.
Yeah, no problem, thank you so much for having me.
Need to talk? AMS Speakeasy offers free one-on-one confidential drop-in peer support sessions with trained volunteers. Our goal is to lend a listening ear and empower you to continue to strive towards wellness. Our services are available Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. and 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. during exam season. Support sessions can be requested at our desk on the main floor of the Nest or by ringing the doorbell outside our private space in room 3121. Learn more by visiting the AMS Speakeasy website. No issue is too big or too small. We're here to listen.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
Okay, we are back on UBC Happy Hour, and we're broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory. I'm Alex Lenz, and that was my interview with Tintin Yang, and she is an outreach worker at the Sexual Assault Support Center here at UBC, and she's also a major in international relations and a minor in Asian Canadian and Asian Migration Studies here at UBC. So yeah, she's super cool, and she's doing some awesome work at the Sexual Assault Support Center. So next up, we're going to hear a track from the UBC Music Initiative. So they are a campus club that is dedicated to bringing people together through music. And they play a lot of like classical, jazz, that kind of stuff. And yeah, so the club was playing in the Nest throughout the week, this week. And it was really nice. There was just classical and kind of jazzy music reverberating through the building, and it was very soothing, I would say. So yeah, they sent us some music, and so we're gonna hear a track called Chillin' with Pete, which is, I don't know who Pete is, but we're gonna chill with him. And the song was produced by Samson Song, who is part of the UBC Music Initiative. So yeah, here is their track, Chillin' with Pete. Thank you. Okay, so we're back on UBC Happy Hour, and you just heard Chillin' with Pete by Samson Song from the UBC Music Initiative. And up next, we're talking about cryptocurrency, which I don't fully understand how it works. Lilaine, do you know anything about cryptocurrency?
Heard about it today.
Yeah. Cryptocurrency is, it's like such a buzzword right now. A lot of people are talking about Bitcoin. I guess the price has just tanked. So Julia Ferry, who knows a lot more about cryptocurrency than either Lilaine and I do, so she interviewed a business student here at UBC who co-founded Golden Dragon Investments, which is a cryptocurrency business. So we're going to hear her interview with him. And then when we come back, we're going to be hanging out with the Speed Cubing Club from UBC. So here it is, guys.
So we're in studio today with DJ, who is a co-founder with Stephen and Kevin from the company called Golden Dragon Investments. So if you'd like to say a little hello and an introduction of yourself, what you do here at UBC, and how you got to the Golden Dragon Investments.
So hello, everyone. My name is DJ, and I'm a third-year business student at the Sauder School of Business. And so we started this company because we all had the same interest in the blockchain technology and also in investments. And so with this shared passion, we found that starting this company, Golden Dragon, allowed us to do something that we're passionate about and then kind of have a sense of individuality, because we're starting a company that's basically our own company, so we have a say in what we want to do. And so this has been a pretty interesting journey for us.
Yeah, that must be. So when did that start exactly?
So this started around October, mm-hmm. Before that, we had different conversations together, and then we were thinking about what is the best way to do this and how can we find a competitive advantage in this industry, because it's such a new industry. And so we were planning, doing a lot of preliminary research, and then in around October, November, that's when we started the process of incorporating our company.
Mm. So this preliminary research, I guess there must have been a lot to do, because blockchain, a lot of people don't know what it is. Do you think you could give me a quick description of what you perceive as blockchain?
Okay, so blockchain is basically, there's a term that is cryptocurrencies, and what is very commonly, people think that cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, that's the first thing that comes to mind. So Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, it's basically a digital currency in which it acts like a medium for exchange, and you can basically transfer this currency around to different people. And then it's also very secure in the transaction, and because you can verify each and every transaction in the world, and also there's a limited supply. Therefore, you can't keep printing or making more Bitcoins, which would cause each value of the Bitcoin to decrease, like how we can print the US dollar.
Interesting. So when you were thinking about blockchain, did you ever think about how political the implications would be to start investing in blockchain?
Yes, I think the political implications are very wide, because banks would always want to have the control and want to centralize everything. And so this is where the blockchain technology comes out. And the people who founded this technology, one of them being Satoshi Nakamoto, the founder of Bitcoin, and he had the vision to decentralize this network. And because he feels that after the 2008 financial crisis, that banks are not that trustworthy. And so this is the reason that he founded the technology of cryptocurrencies, which is still applicable today.
Thinking about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, though, it sounds like quite nefarious in some senses, like what is this money, you know? So I'm just wondering, as a person who's working in investment for Bitcoin, how do you tell people that you could trust this kind of money? And yeah, How do you do that?
Well, to be honest, I also personally view that cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, they all have many negative associations with it, such as the fact that Bitcoin, in the early stages of Bitcoin, many black markets and gray areas, they used Bitcoin to make many under-the-table transactions. Mm-hmm. And so there comes a negative association with Bitcoin. And also with the recent hacks and all that, then people feel that it's not that trustworthy. But then for me, myself, I see it as a digital asset. And in a digital asset, I see that it's able to store value. And basically, the technology here will stand for many years to come. And this is just the beginning of cryptocurrencies, I believe, and blockchain technology.
Mm, interesting. So do you feel like after it becomes an asset and people use it, because people will be able to trust it, it's the reason why it will stay? Or is there more? I'm just curious as how it works, you know? It's like, what makes it so alluring for people to invest in it?
Well, first of all, what makes it so attractive as an investment is because of the soaring prices. And the soaring prices is basically due to speculation. And also because at first, once it was created, the market, the total market capitalization was very small. Therefore, it only needed a few millions in order to move the price up very high compared to the stock market. And so right now, compared to the equities market, cryptocurrencies is relatively small. It's around $500 billion. And compared to the equities where it's like trillions of dollars. And so this makes the price rise very quickly. And even with more institutional investors coming in, the price of these currencies increase rapidly. And it's a lot of people who get in, they think of a get rich kind of scheme, which also has negative implications. But I believe that if you're thinking through and having a solid strategy, like how we almost perfected, then there is a way to tackle this market.
Okay, so could you elaborate on the perfection of kind of having a strategy? I don't know if that's something that's confidential, but if it's something that you could share, it'd be great to kind of get a better picture, perhaps.
Okay, so for our company, Golden Dragon Investments, we have three different income streams. Mm-hmm. And so the reason we have three different diversified income streams is because we can't solely simply trade or invest in the currency because it's way too volatile. So we have to hedge against this risk. And so the first income stream we have is through data mining. And data mining is a process of having GPUs or ASICs in order to mine these cryptocurrencies, such as Bitcoin. And we gradually mine them, and the process of mining is through solving different equations. And these equations is basically verifying the transactions users send to each other. And then after that, a block is created. And then for our second income stream, we do arbitrage trading using a software that we developed. And so through the arbitrage trading, the way it works is because there are multiple exchanges that trade Bitcoin, and through volatile times, the price of Bitcoin in one exchange is different from another exchange. For example, if in one exchange, the price is around 16,000, but then on the other exchange, it's around 16,500, then the software recognizes that, and then it purchases from the one at 16,000 and sells it at 16,500. Although the profits might not be high, but this is a pretty consistent method in gaining income and profit. And once we do that, we just sell it and then hold US dollar because it's more stable than holding Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies overnight. And the final income stream we have is through trading. And through trading is a lot more risky, but of course it has higher risk is higher reward. And that's what I actually specialize in, because I have been trading the equities market before I got into this industry. Mm-hmm. And I use those methods through technical trading, which is looking at different types of graphs and different patterns in order to project and analyze which direction the asset will go. And then I use these methods in order to see which of the currencies is an attractive time to buy, and then I trade those swings.
Wow. Seems like a very complicated system that you guys have developed. So it seems like the three forms of income, and there's three co-founders. Is there any relation of how everyone contributed to this system?
Right, yes. Exactly. So each of us takes care of one of these streams of income. For example, me, myself, I take care of the trading stream of income, where I would make daily trades. And then the other, Steven, my other co-founder, he takes care of the software arbitrage trading. And finally, the last income stream, mining, is what Kevin looks after.
Interesting. But it sounds very much like a normal stock market almost. Is it? Do you feel that once people are investing more money that it becomes stable enough that it will be able to price things? For example, the shoes that we wear, do you think they will be priced in Bitcoin someday?
I think in the future it's definitely possible to have products priced in cryptocurrencies, but I would not use Bitcoin because Bitcoin is actually a very outdated technology, and mm-hmm. the transaction fees are very expensive. Mm-hmm. Therefore, if you were to purchase something using Bitcoin, you would have to pay pretty expensive transaction fees. But then it is possible that in the future there is a cryptocurrency that is more stable in the market and with lower transaction fees and faster timings, then I think it would be definitely possible to have that as a payment method.
Right. So what are some blockchain currencies, I guess, or cryptocurrencies that we would want our eyes on, or that might become very powerful at some point in time?
Well, right now there are a wide variety of cryptocurrencies, but the top ones I would say are Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Ethereum, Ripple, Stellar, Stellar Lumens, Dash, IOTA, Cardano. And these are the ones I would say that are up and rising. And some of them have been here for a while, such as Litecoin is another one.
Interesting. But going back to the idea of cryptocurrency, I've heard that it updates every 10 minutes. Is that correct?
For cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, so people will be solving their problems on their computers, mining, and then every 10 minutes they say, oh, okay, these problems are solved. Yay, the transaction is legit. And then they move on to the next one. Or is that true?
Yes. However, now it's much faster. Once the technology improves, then it's
really?
Even quicker
oh
than
my
that.
Gosh. Wow, so that means that the fluctuations are even more often.
Right. The fluctuations happen every second, really.
Really? Wow. It's hard to imagine people being able to comfortably purchase things. What do you imagine Bitcoin to be useful for? You know, like, if you can't price, I'm just imagining, okay, I'm going to go buy a piece of chocolate, and I have one Bitcoin in my cell phone. And I go and walk over and I try to buy the chocolate, but they say, oh, sorry, you can't buy it anymore because your one Bitcoin is actually not worth the chocolate anymore. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the thing with the cryptocurrencies right now. It's because it's too volatile. Therefore, once it's too volatile, then there's a lot of risks involved. And so that's why Bitcoin would not be good as a payment. As a tool or a medium for payments. But I think, as I said earlier, I think that in the future, if there is to be a cryptocurrency that is much more stable, if they could find a way, such as maybe some slow inflation or a steadily growing supply, then that would be more stable. But I'm not quite sure of the technical implications of how to make a cryptocurrency that is stable enough to be used as a payment method. But I think that's definitely something that is possible.
Mm-hmm. It's a very polarizing topic, isn't it? Cryptocurrency. A lot of people say, oh, it's the future for democratization. You can have a more stronger vote because instead of having money that is ruled by banks' whims, you can have it for the people who are mining, and you can diversify it by having many people mining. But then some people say, oh, you know, it's a big bubble that's happening, so we don't know what's going to happen. It's very unpredictable. So I guess being part of this wave of new technology, how does that make you feel?
Well, it's definitely life-changing. And at first, before blockchain was created, I used to think that, I wish I was born during the dot-com boom, because during the dot-com boom, that was a very good time to be in the market, and such as if you purchased Apple stocks or Amazon stocks, PayPal stocks, then it would be a very attractive time to be in. But then now I feel that this is another opportunity for investors to get in and capitalize on these gains. However, I want to say that I also do personally think that cryptocurrencies is a bubble, but then I think that the bubble will not burst yet, because right now the market capitalization is around $500 to $600 billion, whereas the dot-com bubble, when it burst, it was around $3 to $4 trillion. So we still have around a long way to go, but eventually, once the market capitalization for cryptocurrencies reaches that level of how the dot-com bubble bursted, then I think we would be looking into areas where it could burst soon enough. But during those times, I would probably be very cautious and I would stay away from the market.
Interesting. And there would be definitely social implications for a bubble to be growing like that, would you think? Or,
well, I think so too, that there would definitely be social implications for that. And I think this is also very similar to other bubbles we've seen. Mm-hmm. And one of the things where we can identify that it is a bubble is the fact that right now there are a lot of non-investors who are basically casual people who want to get into these markets because they see that it is an opportunity to get rich quick. But in that sense, if you are investing without foresight, then I think it's very risky. Unless you have a well-devised strategy, then it would be much more risk-friendly, I'd say, even though it's still very volatile.
Right. So I guess this is the warning sign to the audience. Don't just invest without thinking.
Yes. That's right.
Yeah, I guess your career path is very fascinating. And I guess I'd like to bring it back to UBC just because we're part of the UBC Currents Affair Collective, and we want to show that there are many opportunities that UBC students can grab. So I guess, do you feel like UBC was a big contributor to this situation that you're in, or how do you think it affected you being in the School of Economics, I'm guessing?
I'm in the Sasar School of Business.
Yeah.
And I think that it definitely has had an impact on myself because I'm surrounded with people who are all very motivated to make a change in the world, and all of these people are very bright students and who always strive forward, and with that mentality it also makes me want to do something in the world and also want me to start something of myself. Mm-hmm. And with that entrepreneurial passion that I see around UBC, specifically around in the business school or in the classrooms that I see, this encourages me to make something of my own and kind of the saying that be my own boss. So that was the motivator for me to push and actually start this business.
Do you feel that being your own boss, it kind of reflects the type of world that we live as a generation? In the internet age and the information age, there's a lot of individuality, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I definitely think that in this digital age, it's much easier to be your own boss, because with access to the internet, there is a wide variety of things you can do. And so with that access to the internet, there are a million things that you can do to earn your own revenue. For example, last year, I also started a e-commerce business. And this was done solely through the internet. And how I started it was I made a website online through Shopify. And then I contacted different suppliers in Asia, such as in Thailand and in Vietnam and China. And then I listed their products from their factories onto my website. And then I just took photos, very clean photos of their products, and listed it on my website. And then I marketed my website using Facebook ads and Google ads. And then just by simply doing that, I spent less than $1,000 on setting up the business, paying for my Facebook and Google ads. And then I was able to sell these products very well, actually. And so, for example, if a supplier sells me a t-shirt for $5 and I just list them at my website for $10, and then that's a $5 profit already.
Interesting.
So I definitely think that in this day and age, it's definitely possible for anyone to start their own business or to basically be their own boss.
Right. So having that tool at your fingertips, and you mentioning earlier before that you were thinking that there would be more changes that you can see in the world. What are some of the changes that you'd like to see, and how do you envision Bitcoin or cryptocurrency to be a change in the world?
Well, first of all, I think Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, the way that it will change the world is through decentralization and through taking away the power and the monopoly that the banks have, the governments have, and it will allow us to cultivate more of a sense of individuality in the world. And with this individuality, we're able to simply do whatever we want to do and without being suppressed or controlled too much by our banks or by the government. And so I think this is quite revolutionizing.
Indeed. It's an extreme extension of human freedom. All right. Thank you, DJ. You are from the Golden Dragon Investments, a co-founder with Stephen and Kevin. Thank you so much for coming in.
No problem, Julia. Thank you.
Beside, proximity to the arts is cleansing for the soul.
If there's any lesson we can take from High School Musical, it's that the arts are a vital part of any community. Join the CATR Arts Collective to see movies, theater, dance, or live comedy shows and share your thoughts on air. The Arts Report airs every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Email volunteer@CATR.ca to get involved.
Do you have any awareness of what's been happening with newspapers in the last 10 years?
Not at all. I mean, truth is, I don't even get them anymore. I just read the news on my phone. It's so much better, and it's free.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The future of news media is in your hands.
If you're interested in independent journalism and current affairs, CITR's News Collective is for you. Help pound down stories about diverse and underrepresented issues in the Lower Mainland for Democracy Watch, airing every Thursday at 5 p.m. Email volunteer at citr.ca to get involved.
All the questions.
Okay, so we are back on UBC Happy Hour, and you just heard Julia Ferry talking to Dijon, who is the founder of a cryptocurrency business. So yeah, thank you, Julia, for that. So we're back with the Speed Cubing Club of UBC. Woo! So two members. So do you guys want to introduce yourselves and what you do in the club?
All right, Woon.
My name is Woon, and I'm the president of Speed Cubing Club.
Yeah, so my name is Arina. I'm the treasurer of the Speed Cubing Club. We're actually a new club in UBC.
Yeah, so what does the club do?
Yeah, so we aim to promote the speed cubing hobby to UBC students, because apparently there's no speed cubing club here. But there's a large Rubik's Cube community in Vancouver, so we aim to spread that hobby. Yeah, and create somehow a culture in UBC.
To promote speed cubing, the interest to build this thing here in Vancouver, because in Vancouver it's actually a very big thing, speed cubing, but surprisingly there's no such club in UBC, sadly. So we want to be the one to bring this to people.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you guys know each other from high school, right?
Yes, we do. Yeah.
And it was you were saying it's it was really popular at your high school.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, both of us are from Malaysia, and we have this kind of club in our high school as well, and there's a lot of competition in Malaysia, almost once every month.
Yep.
And that's a lot.
And wow. I personally have kind of organized the Malaysia Cube Open, which is a national cubing competition. Yeah, where cubers from all around the world come to this competition and compete.
Wow, you organized that.
I was part of the committee. It was really, really fun.
Okay,
yeah,
wow.
I enjoyed myself a lot. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, okay. So I should say that they're casually speed cubing as they're talking to us right now. And I'm so impressed. I'm what? And also the president is wearing a sweater that says addicted to the cube, and it looks amazing. So we have a lovely collection of speed cubes in front of us. So do you want to maybe tell us a bit about the different types of cubes that exist?
Oh yeah, so the classic one are 3x3. Yeah, so
yes.
Yep. So if you go to competition, there's other types of cubes as well. You don't just compete in 3x3. There's 2x2s, 4x4s, and up to 7x7. There's different shapes, cubes, where you turn in a diagonal way instead of the standard 3x3 way. There's square ones where it can actually change shapes.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's so cool. This one's changing. There's sometimes, I don't know, is that a hexagon? I don't even know what shape that is. Wow. Okay. So, okay. And which ones are you guys best at solving?
For me personally, I would like the 3x3 and the pyramix. Yeah. And perhaps the 2x2 sometimes.
And what's the fastest you've ever solved a cube?
Not very fast. For 3x3, I guess the fastest I've ever achieved is 30 seconds.
30?
Yeah.
Okay.
But the world record is 4 or 5
yeah,
seconds.
Yeah, it's 4.5 seconds. And the guy who broke the record just broke it again this morning.
We were, yeah. Lelaine and I were researching this before, and we were on the Wikipedia page, and it's this guy Felix from New Zealand, and
yep.
he's 22. He that seems really young to me, but are most people who do speed cubing how old are they?
It's quite a big range. I know people who's in their 30s and still speed cube and organize competition and stuff. That would be when I go competition, there's as young as 5 years old who go to competition.
Yeah, because you guys were mentioning, so you were just at a competition recently.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, so do you want to tell us about that competition? Did you guys do well? Or
Personally, I didn't do well. I kind of panicked, and then I...
it's Arena's first competition in Vancouver.
Yeah.
But okay. I've been a few past years and stuff.
He has been to Calgary Open, places.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Like Calgary and mostly in Vancouver. Yeah, mm-hmm. And then it's not like I knew that I couldn't win because the winner in the competition is always like less than 10 seconds. But I aim to break my personal best,
yep.
And I broke like most of it, so I'm really happy.
Wow, congratulations! And what was your personal best? Like what did you get?
So in the competition, like I once solved like 14 seconds, like officially. During practice, I can do like 11 seconds, like just once, but I averaged about like 17 seconds. Yeah, that's for like 3x3, and then that's like 4x4. I can do like 1 minute. It's not really fast, but I'm really satisfied because I'm like...
It's fast to me.
Yeah,
you're like 11 seconds. I'm like, maybe if you give me like 11 days, I would be able to get to it. So, okay, so for someone who has never done a Rubik's Cube before, which I think that's me. I think I've tried, you know, in vain to solve a Rubik's Cube, but never in any serious capacity. I don't know, Lalaine, have you ever like solved a Rubik's Cube?
No, I've never even touched one until today.
Okay, that's so this nice. Is brand new to us. So what advice would you give us for solving a cube?
Well, first of all, to not be afraid to try. When I first started, I was really afraid. I'm like, oh no, I'm not gonna do this. There's just too many algorithms to memorize. But when you try to pick up one and you fiddle with it a bit, then you start to figure out how it actually works, and it'll come to you naturally. Yeah.
I'm like, naturally.
Naturally.
Okay, so I'm gonna grab the pyramid one.
Okay.
Or yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I was trying the pyramid one before. And it made no sense to me, but you guys were saying that you know there are algorithms,
yep,
to this, so it's kind of like you're going by behavior is what, mm-hmm, you were
patterns
talking about.
Yeah.
So does everyone kind of have their own pattern, or are there kind of techniques that are like agreed upon in the community?
Yeah, the latter.
I think that's like different methods.
There's
like
a lot
for pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Technically, I didn't solve this using algorithms. It's just by observing. And then, because this is actually easier than the 3x3.
That's true.
The pyramid.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I'm like, why am I feeling so
miserable? Just because of its weird shape, yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't get it.
Don't get confused by it. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so, okay, and you guys are also mentioning that there are some people... Well, there's one where you solve it with your feet.
Uh-huh.
Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah, like... I'm not sure why the event existed, but yeah, it's like when cubers don't have anything else to do, they strive to challenge themselves. So they came out with more events,
yep,
like do it with one handed. They want to memorize it, and they want to memorize more, so that's multi-blind. And they come up with like, oh, I've done sewing with my hands, so why not try my feet? Yeah, so that's like cube specially for feet, and it's really big.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And it sounds amazing.
That does sound
just
so nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
The fingers. Just.
Yeah. So there are some that are magnetic and others that are like, I don't know, not magnetic.
Yeah. That's like magnetized, and that's like most of the speed cubes have like lubricants in it.
Okay.
So it can make it like fast and go
smoother,
smooth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can match your finger tricks and stuff. Yeah.
So, okay. So before we wrap up, do you can you guys solve one like here on the show?
Oh yeah, sure.
We can do the 3x3.
Yeah. Okay. And there's
should
like
we time it or something.
Yeah, yeah. So you guys brought
see
in this like timer, like machine.
I
don't know, a machine. You're like laughing at me. You're like, this girl does not know what she's talking
about. It's just a timer.
What do you call this timer thing?
Yeah, we just call it a timer.
Timer.
Yeah.
You just call it a timer.
It's,
okay.
It's just
a timer
for cubes. Yeah.
So for people listening, there's this thing that is, I guess you kind of turn it on and then your hands are on top of it. And as soon as they come off, that's when the time starts. And then for it to end, you put your hands back on. So you're solving, what are you solving, a 3x3?
Yeah.
Okay, and this is the one that you're best at?
Kinda, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to see how long it takes.
Oh, I hope I don't screw up. Please pray that I don't screw up. I'm going to go 3, 2...
He's solving it. We're so excited. Oh my God. His hands are moving really quickly. There's these intense finger techniques that... Okay, so now there's one side that's fully white. Oh, I can't even...
Oh.
Wow! Whoa. Okay, how long was that? It's done.
18, 11. 18 seconds.
Okay, and is that good for you?
Yeah, it's kind of my average.
Okay.
Sometimes
okay.
If I do bad, I can go like 25, 30 seconds.
I didn't see it coming.
It's, yeah. Oh my gosh. It's bad for me, but it's like, yeah.
It's a good try.
Oh my gosh. Okay, that's so cool. And okay, so lastly, you guys were kind of saying that also there aren't many women involved in speed cubing. So you're kind of a trailblazer.
Well... Yeah, actually, I would encourage more women to come into this thing. Yeah, because it's actually quite fun. It's not gender constricted.
Yeah. No, yeah. I think that's so cool.
I would really love to see more women participating, actually.
Yeah.
You can clearly see that in competitions because out of 150 participants, there will only be less than 10 girls there. Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Wow, okay, this is so cool. So if people want to join the Speed Cubing Club, how can they join?
Well, they can contact us through the UBC's Speed Cubing Facebook page.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have it there. We have all the information there. And plus tomorrow, we have this meeting that's for everyone, not only entitled to UBC students, also to the public, who can come and join and then have fun.
Yeah, just come and take a look and play some cubes.
Touch some cubes.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Yeah. I love the cubes. I'm like, I'm gonna go buy a Rubik's Cube and never solve it. But it's okay.
You guys can come too. We can teach you. It'll be really, really fun.
Yeah. I think I would need to be taught. Yeah.
Like, and they have like a big bag case of cubes.
That's just me. Cubes. I'm just, you know, addicted.
Yeah, he is really, really
addicted.
Yeah.
His sweater says so. Yeah. So it has to be true. Okay, well, thank you so much both for joining us.
Thank you, you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, and so we're this is the end of the show. I had a lot of fun with you guys. This was super cool. So yeah, thank you for listening to UBC Happy Hour. And up next is Radio Pizza Party on CITR 101.9. So keep listening for that show. Thank you, and have a great weekend, everyone.
Yay. Now repeat after me. Bugger off. Bugger off. Sod. Sod. Bloody. Bloody. Now put them all together. Bugger off, you bloody sod.
Bugger off, you bloody sod.
Okay, you're in. Let's smash things up.